Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is episode 84. And we're going to talk about Nuxt, Vue, and GraphQL as time allows. And today, I've got my famous host, the host with the most, Mr. Ring My Ward Bell.
Ring my bell. Ring my bell.
You know what? I do know that song.
Yeah.
And everybody else is like, I wish I didn't.
That's right. It's going to be an earworm for now.
Oh, great. Great. So, Ward, have you done a lot with Nuxt or Vue?
I have done zero, but I have quite a bit of experience with the Angular equivalent of Nuxt. I'm not even sure that I'm talking about the same technology.
That's a good point for today to talk about. Yeah.
So why don't we find out what these are, and then we'll find out if I know something similar. I've spent a lot of time in data. I know we're going to also talk about. I wanted to say OData because that's the one that I had a lot of experience with, but GraphQL. And I'm going to ask our guest what if anything, he knows about OData. Stuff like that.
I think this will be a great episode. And I'm glad we found Daniel Rowe because he seems to know quite a bit about this. So, Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are really happy to have you here because we've been dying to talk about some of these topics. And honestly, I would love to have three episodes, one on each one of them, because they're so cool in different ways here. So for our audience, let's get everybody acquainted with who Daniel is. Daniel is starting a company that helps businesses supporting working parents. And he's always loved technology, but he's also studied law, founded a message consultancy, and taught Greek. That's quite a diverse background, Daniel.
Well, the saying, jack of all trades, master of none.
That's kind of like us with technology these days. There used to be a time in our lives when it seemed like you could just stay in one particular stack, one sandbox, and things were, your life would be okay. But now it seems like every week you have to learn something new.
Did you have any formal computer science training? I'm just curious. It comes up out on the... There's a lot of people wondering whether you have to have formal computer science background to get into this biz.
If by formal computer science background, you don't include teach yourself Visual Basic in 30 days, which I seem to recall I picked up when I was about 13, then no, I don't have any formal.
I think I remember those books.
It was at 30?
It might even have been less. It was so much fun. It was like magic. Just figuring out how to make something on the screen that looks like the other programs on the screen.
So how did you possibly find a job coming out of, well, here you were doing law. I think in our pre-show, you said you had studied theology. And then, neither of those are exactly feeders into the software business. How did you get there?
Well, I started my own agency, which is one way to go. The concept was a company that helped people say things simply. So cutting through the chaff. And we started as a writing company. And then we very, very quickly, because I love technology, very quickly we added a design and development side to the business. And I did it all really to start with in the tech side. And gradually brought on board a good team. And so that we did that for a few years. Before we actually built a product for one of our clients that we were so on board with, we ended up joining forces with them. And that's what I'm doing these days. I'm actually starting up this new company.
So that's a great story, a great arc. I hear that one way or another. People sort of stumble into the technology because they were doing something else. And they needed to put somebody had to do it and discovered an appetite for it. So all of you out there, this is just another example of how you can get into this game without having to have studied in university. I didn't either, by the way. So I've never had a CS course in my life.
Really? Not a single CS course for you, Mr.
Nope,
Bell.
Nope. I audited a few sessions of one by a guy named Michael Stonebreaker for any of you out there who know Postgres. He was the inventor of that. But I was quickly bored because at that time I'd spent so many years that I, as a actual practitioner, that it was a little basic.
Little basic, which brings us back to, I did find it. It is Teach Yourself Visual Basic in 21 Days.
Yep.
And it was a bestseller.
Was it?
Yeah, it seems to be from Nathan Gurewitch, is one of the authors of this. And you can still buy it on Amazon these days. I think I actually read this book like 25 years ago. I think it was that long ago. Oh my gosh.
I mean, Visual Basic is I'm embarrassed now to say it, but I loved it. It was really simple. You could draw buttons on the screen and then write pretty straightforward code to make things happen.
I enjoyed it too. Yes,
one of the key apps I recall I built was one that I discovered Project Gutenberg at the same time. And so when I was doing my schoolwork, I'd be reading some Dickens novel or something like that. And I built this app so that when I heard my parents coming around the corner, I'd press this hotkey, and instantly on the screen would flash all of my schoolwork, absolutely beautifully.
Wow. Well, we just shifted the topic of this show to Visual Basic in 21 minutes.
We did, but you shouldn't be embarrassed. My goodness, any language, anything that gets one excited about making the computer jump around and do stuff is great, and you can write great things in almost anything, and you can write bad things in. Let me say this: you can write bad things in almost any language you choose.
Yes,
because I know, because I have done it.
And you know, I don't often swear word on these podcasts and whatnot, but I will tell you, one of my famous sayings is, "I can write crap." And I usually substitute a word there in any language. So anytime somebody picks on a language or technology, it's not the language or technology that's bad. Sometimes we can write.
With few exceptions.
Yeah.
I will unequivocally tell you from rich experience, the COBOL is horrible.
It is although they're poisonous. Hiring in New Jersey right now.
I know, but it is actually, here's the thing that makes it hard. It is poisonous. It poisons your brain in a way that no other language can. So I'm sorry.
And there goes half our audience.
There goes half of our audience.
So just before we switch over to the topic, something I found fascinating in the time machine here that we've been talking about with Visual Basic, because that was my first, like, really, I love this language. To give you an idea, can you imagine if you were learning new technology today that you had to buy a book that would take 21 days to learn it? Like somebody told you, I'm going to learn Vue. It's going to take you 21 days. That would feel kind of lengthy right now. And the premier book to teach you it was 986 pages. How would you feel about that, Daniel?
Do you know, it's difficult to put myself back in that position. I don't think it matches today. We want short videos, you know, 4 or 5 minutes that take you step by step through, or maybe a tutorial that engages with something real world and gets you somewhere by the end.
Yeah, I agree. I think the world has changed. I mean, our expectations of how to learn technology, I just don't think I could put up with my attention span, a 1,000-page book like I did 25 years ago. And this came out in 1995, by the way, to give everybody a sense of it.
From a tech perspective, I think that's true. A good 1,000-page read, though, is, you know, you can't knock it. But I'm talking War and Peace.
Exactly. So speaking of Ward and Peace, let's have some piece of Vue, Nuxt, and GraphQL.
Let's go there.
Daniel, could you explain a little bit what Vue, Nuxt, and GraphQL are for our audience?
Sure.
And now a break from a word from our sponsors. Hey, Ward, you know, I was building an application the other day, and I pulled in this really cool UI component, but it brought along a lot of dependencies with it. How do you deal with that?
I don't like that, John. It reminds me that the AG grid, which is an advanced editable data table that we use in a lot of our enterprise apps because it addresses the complex scenarios we encounter. AG Grid doesn't have any dependencies at all.
Zero dependencies. Well, tell me, why is that good? Like, what is the value of having zero dependencies?
Well, it's wonderful not having to wonder if while I'm pulling that in, I'm also pulling jQuery in or Lodash or who knows what. in part because that's extra stuff coming over the wire. It's extra files that I don't know what they're all about. It means when my client's security team has to evaluate this, they're evaluating AG Grid and not everything else that might be slipping in under the covers or something that we have to worry about there.
You know, it's great to see this day and age, you can have a zero dependency library that does something like complex data grid functionality. So all of you out there, do check out AG Grid at their website at ag-grid.com. And we're back. And you were just about to explain to us what Nuxt Vue and GraphQL are.
Well, Nuxt is another great framework. But Vue is a JavaScript framework. People will have heard about of others, React, Angular. Vue is known for the declarative model. So you say, I'd like to have a web page that reflects this data. And then you change the data and the web page changes to follow it. Really, really cool the first time you come across it. And I'm really looking forward to the to building some production applications with Vue 3, which is out, the beta is out any day now. Nuxt is a framework for Vue. The idea being that you can start with almost no boilerplate of your own. You install Nuxt, you put a file in the pages directory, and it's instantly turned into a server that will serve that up when you go to that route. It's pretty powerful out of the box.
Before you go into GraphQL, why do you need Nuxt with Vue? Like, why can't you just Vue? Why do you need Nuxt on top of that? What does it add?
So I think there's you can go any different route you want. So
sure.
you can build your Vue app from the ground up. Nuxt starts with lots of sensible defaults, and it also adds in server-side rendering to start with. Then I'd recommend anyone starting with Vue to start with Nuxt, because as you grow in your knowledge of how the framework works, you can customize it completely. In fact, you might find at the end of the day that you're doing yourself with your own code most of what Nuxt did for you in the beginning. So you can really swap out your own code for Nuxt as you go. But it's a great initial developer experience. So you have pretty much, well, you have a server-side rendered app to start with without needing to set that up, which means that what arrives at your browser when you load the page is full HTML.
That's the big piece of Nuxt, right? The server-side rendering piece of it?
That's the big piece of it. There are a couple of other things that go alongside it, but yes, server-side rendering is key.
And why is that server-side? What does server-side rendering do for you after you? Because you've already explained in a sentence what it is, but why does it matter to you?
So I think it's a better user experience. So what happens when a server-side rendered page comes down to the browser is that it takes all the normal round trips. You have to download download the web page, download the CSS if there are separate CSS files, download the JavaScript bundle. You'll have to all of that has to make it to the browser. But as soon as it does, you get a rendered web page that looks as you might expect, and then it goes through and hydrates that web page, which means matching every node in the DOM with a node in the shadow DOM, and basically making it reactive, so that any future changes, any clicks of buttons, any updates from AJAX requests or whatever trigger changes in the web page. If you don't have server-side rendering, almost the same thing happens, barring the fact that you don't get the initial page load, that initial visibility of the HTML. What you get is a blank page that still relatively quickly renders a page. And even though it's a matter of microseconds, I think it makes a difference to people when they see something, when they view it.
So it's really dedicated to that first time to first paint on your screen, right?
You almost said view. Time to first view with view.
Yeah, huh? I don't want to. Yeah, there's nothing. But that's its. You know, there is once it's done, its job is to give the user something to look at really quickly. And once it's done that, it kind of gets out of the way, or does it continue to make an appearance through the rest of the experience?
So I should say that Nuxt as a framework isn't only about server-side rendering, because you can create single-page apps as well. You can also pre-render everything, so just end up with a collection of static HTML pages that were produced from a view app. But yes, once it arrives on your page, it's a single page app from that point forward. It's not downloading HTML anymore. From that point, it's just downloading JavaScript bundles, which have been split so that they match the routes you're going to visit. But that's just what you would expect from a normal SPA.
Right. So how does this relate to, you know, why was this fast loading feature important for your application? Because I want to make the argument that it's important for some applications, but it may not be important for all applications. So I'm curious why that seemed, although there are people who tell me that I have to do it for everything. But I assume, Daniel, you're not going to tell me what I have to do. You're just going to tell me why it matters to you.
So it matters to me because, well, I don't want to get too much into telling you all about the wonderful app I'm making, but a big part of the particular app I'm working on is engagement. So it's important that people feel that it's fast and responsive and that they want to go back to it.
What kind of people are these people? I mean that in the gentlest, most positive sense. In other words, are these people coming for fun? Are they coming to learn? Are they coming because they have to? Are they coming because they want to?
They're working parents. So the company is called Parent Scheme, and it makes an app, a web app for employers to provide to their employees. So if you're a working parent, you can get lots of information from Google about how to juggle work and career, for example. But we put that all in one place, and there's lots of content. Whenever you're looking at a resource site like that, particularly one you don't have to go to, why would you? What's the reason that you'll choose to fire up Parent Scheme in your web browser or download that off the App Store as opposed to Googling? And a big part is what it feels like. So it needs to feel modern. It needs to feel relevant. It needs to be fast. I may have said that once before, but I feel
that. I buy that proposition. I happen to be a guy who only writes applications for people who have to use it. They don't have a choice in the matter. And therefore, you know, it's like they're in the prison cell. I can take as long as I want because they're not.
Yeah, I mean, it might make some sense to explain what you mean by that too, Ward, because folks may not understand. Like, who has to use an app?
I'm being somewhat facetious there.
Yeah, but they do have to use it.
But they do have to in the same way that you have to use your email program, right? You don't pick an email program because it renders quickly. You pick it because you got to be on email. I mean, if it renders quickly, that's nice. But that's probably not why you pick it. Or if you have to go to some place and fill in forms, you got to do it. You're not there. You wouldn't have a choice. It's not something you're doing casually. You're sitting down to do a job. And likely, once you start that job, you're willing to live with it for quite a period of time. Or if you're an employee and you have to do something. Now, it isn't I'm not arguing that render speed is irrelevant or that you should inflict a terrible user experience on people. But the pressure to have instantaneous rendering is just not there for that audience. Whereas I can see, and that's why I was asking you about it, Daniel, I can see that for your audience, these are tired folks who have to figure out, you know, they're just coming in and they want this information and they want it to be delighted and they don't have to do it. And if it's not delightful, they're gone. My people have to come. I don't have to worry about whether they're going to run away.
Well, I wonder if I have a reason that might even win you over. So,
Ooh, wait, you're going to win Ward over.
Good.
Everyone pay attention. Go for it.
So one of the things about the fact that the initial render happens on the server is that you can be very explicit about authentication, about permissions. It's not relevant for lots of websites, so things that are public, but it is relevant for us. So the content isn't just public for anyone to access. Now, there are, of course, strategies for dealing with this with a single-page app, but you can do more with a server-side rendered app. It feels, in some ways, like going back to the days of servers. We actually run it on a Lambda, but that initial request comes with its cookies. You can authorize the user. You can redirect them to a different place. You can, per route, perhaps, decide whether they're allowed to view that page or not, which I think in some cases you could even do things you wouldn't be able to do with just your single page app.
Now, you just dropped a couple of really interesting bombs there and kind of just casually walked away from them like, oh, and by the way, we're hosting this whole thing in a Lambda. A Lambda, you mean like serverless functions on AWS, right?
Yes. So we use Zeit now alongside Lambdas we've created directly on AWS. But yes, it's basically, obviously there's a server, and there are lots and lots of them. So it deployed around the world to about 50 different locations where that code runs. The key thing for lots of people who opt to run things in a serverless fashion is that they don't have to worry about the infrastructure. So they don't have to worry about provisioning that underlying OS. They don't have to worry about web server configuration. They don't have to worry about security updates to the platform. They just have to say, when this endpoint gets hit, I want this code to run and return some kind of response. And so often people use that for APIs, and they say, when this data comes in, I run this, my function. That's often why it's called FaaS, or functions as a service. And then This is the response that comes back. But you can do more than that, of course. You can do what we do. You can return an entire rendered page and basically point people to your JavaScript, which is on a content delivery network somewhere. So actually our Lambda only gets called once per session. And after that, you're purely on CDN.
So let me walk this back for a sec and make sure I understand you. And correct me where I'm wrong, okay? You've got your application, which is serving a bunch of server-side HTML and assets. What you've done is the first time somebody hits that, your Lambda function is actually rendering those. It's returning the HTML and the assets to the browser, but that's actually going to be cached on the CDN, so subsequent times they're not invoking the Lambda to get that. Is that correct?
That you can do that as well. So, but that's not exactly what we're doing. So you can when... So it depends what kind of response you're returning. If it's authenticated, you don't want it cached. Yep. For us, we're returning responses that depend on who the user is who's requesting them. So we don't want that cached. But if you are if you're returning something like, for example, the result of a search query, that you want that to be the same always. You don't want to have to look in the database again a second time. You can write a beautiful little function that queries your database. Whether that's a JSON file or whether it's some kind of backend, and returns the data along with a header that informs AWS. Never bother calling this Lambda again. It's never going to change. This is always going to be the answer for that query. So yes, I think if I understood you rightly, that was what you were pointing out, John.
Right. So conditionally, there's times you would do that and times you wouldn't do that inside your code. But that's different than traditional servers where you might host up a Node server or ASP.NET or Java or something else where you'd host your entire set of server-side assets, in this case using Nuxt, with your HTML. Instead of having a server do that, still a server with serverless, but instead of having a formal server doing that with Node Express, for example, you're doing that with serverless functions using Lambda,
Exactly. Right? So okay. that's for the front end. But I would be remiss, since we're talking about Nuxt, not to mention another feature that it has, which is server middleware, which is very confusingly titled and is soon to be renamed. But server middleware in a Nuxt context is effectively the same. It's a function that runs on the same server that's rendering everything, but doesn't get bundled into the client side bundle. Instead, it is effectively a node server. So if you're writing a Nuxt app, you can in the same code base write your server and your front end client, and then you can wrap it all up and deploy it to a serverless function or on a old-fashioned server.
You know, that's fascinating, because I'm thinking about, we always come back together, and Ward's great at telling us this story, because, you know, every time we think we've invented something new in technology, he's like, but wait a minute. And he's right. So what we started, you know, years ago, we had everything server-side, and you mentioned that, Daniel, maybe use ASP.NET, Java, whatever. And then we kind of went to this whole front-end thing with all these frameworks. And now with tools like Nuxt, it sounds like with this server middleware, now you can not only do your client-side routes on the server with Nuxt and your APIs there if you'd like to, but now you can also do what you were doing with like Node Express middleware or ASP.NET web API middleware inside of Nuxt and all have it in one place? Or yes. Did I follow you wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. You can.
I have not used Nuxt more than a demo, quite frankly. I've run the demo, but that's not using it. So that's fascinating.
Well, if you want a tour around our code base.
Well, that would be fun. I might take you up on that. But I you know, since John referred to the ancient one here, I will say that I have seen this this pendulum swing wildly between let's do it on the client, let's do it on the server. Well, actually, it always starts with the server first. So it's server, client, server, client, server, client, server, client. And despite the fact that servers and networks have gotten so much better, all my life's experience tells me the more you do on the client, the better. The more responsive it is, the more insulated you are from having to rely on the server. You don't have to have, you can actually run disconnected. But certainly, you cannot beat the responsiveness of an application running on the client. And every time the pendulum starts to swing back to the server, which it has with this whole server-side rendering thing, I throw up in my mouth a little.
Is that so a good thing or bad thing? Just
well, it depends on what I had for lunch, John. But in general, I would say that's not as tasty as it was the first time. So I hear you, Daniel, and you, by the way, are one among many who are trying to convince me that I should get excited about it. But and you know what? If it's easy, here's the critical thing. When somebody tickles my skeptical bone and say, you know, you could really benefit from this, and I say, yeah, but you know, if it's easy, I'll give it a go. If it's like miles and miles of things I have to learn, and it's going to, and I'm at risk that the server side render, you know, well, if you don't do this, then it isn't going to quite server side render, or it's going to look like it's going to get the data twice, and it's going to look like they can push the button, but they can't. And you know, as soon as everybody starts talking to me about all the wrinkles and all the special things I'm going to have to do, and all the work I'm going to do this thing I don't believe in anyway. I ain't going there. But if you were to tell me like, hey, Ward, Nuxt, just try the server-side render and just flip a switch, buddy. Give it a go. It might work for you. Now I'm interested. Is it anywhere near like flip a switch and have fun?
Let's take a break from a word from our sponsors.
Hey, are you building apps in React, Angular, Node, or some other framework? Well, with NX, you can build your full stack apps in a shared mono repo, integrate with modern tools, and reinforce best practices. You'll get advanced code generation and automatically configured tooling like Cypress, Jest, and Prettier that will simplify your workflow. NX also helps you simplify the relationships between applications and shared libraries to make it easier to share more code and develop more consistently across teams. And the best part is you'll build higher quality apps and spend less time on configuration. So visit nx.dev to get Narwhal's popular open source toolkit for monorepo development today.
And we're back. And you're about to tell us why it's easy to Ward.
Absolutely. You have read my mind, John. It is literally the matter of changing one flag in your Nuxt configuration file. So you just say, instead of mode universal, you change it to mode spar, and presto, your application is now fully client-side rendered. But my order of preferences, because I completely get what you're saying about points of failure, is to fully static render every page. So you get all the benefits of content delivery network for every single page that you're sending out.
I'm thinking now about your application. Your users are mostly consuming stuff, right? Are they actually entering any information?
So yes, our users are. So we have a coaching-based approach. So people interact with articles and resources, and their responses.
By doing what? They click on something, or do they actually fill in forms, or
both? So there are. They might answer questions, do that with a significant other, work through something together, or they might use. So for example, we have a return planner. So somebody coming off of paternity or maternity leave might be thinking about how they're going to enter the workplace again. And they can go through this guided tour that walks them through some questions and gives them some recommendations. So yes, they will be putting data down, and that data does need to be stored. So we have to have a back end. So if that's what you're getting at with your question.
Well, no, I was getting about at how interactive the data and how intense the data capture from the user is, because I wasn't imagining, because so much of what you were talking is benefit points. Like when I think about the applications I work on, which are forms over data, which is what a lot of, you know, which is not the whole world, but which is a lot of the world of paid development work.
A lot of the business apps, yeah.
Yep, a lot of line of business apps. You know, I got a screen full of stuff that people have to enter data in, and it's got to update on, you know, when I do this, then that thing has to happen. But if I say use this other value, then other things have to happen. And I collect a lot of data from the screen, and then we move to the next page. That is definitely not a content site. That is, it's a forms over data business app. And I'm having, maybe you're telling me that I could just as easily statically render that, but I can't for the life of me figure out how I would do that without constantly making server trips, which are death in a forms over data.
So when you, let me rewind, because when I say statically rendering your entire app, so I think that's the top of the tier in terms of performance for me, because you get zero time spent by the server rendering. You get all the benefits of what you would normally see with an SPA, which is an immediate response from a CDN. But what happens is just the same as that server-side rendered app. It comes to the user's computer, and from that point on, it's hydrated, and you get an SPA. So it's not then that when they click next, or when they click a menu item, that it redownloads another HTML page. From that point on, it's an SPA. But what you do get is the initial full HTML that's coming down to your user's computer, but it's not coming from a server that's had to respond to that request. It's coming purely from a CDN where the entire page is cached.
So the cache and all the JavaScript is out at the CDN.
Exactly. So that is top performance. But the moment you, and I would always start there, but then the moment you have a need for a server somewhere to customize the response, so now that need might be something like it's based on data that's changing, although there are other solutions. You don't necessarily need to go straight to server rendering for that. You might, for example, trigger a rebuild in your CI/CD pipeline, or you might use a stale while revalidate strategy to serve the old version of the page and instantly refresh it when it arrives at the user's computer. But if you do need server-side rendering, and it might be that authentication or a permissions-based app is a reason for that, then actually you can render those routes individually and conditionally on the server, and the ones which don't change and don't require customization for the user. They can just be served straight from the content delivery network. And then, of course, it's worth saying that if there ever is a problem, Nuxt and other frameworks, I have no doubt, offer a fallback HTML, 200.html file, which is basically your normal SPA. So if anything doesn't work, it's fine. You don't actually need the server. You just download that file, so if you're using a provider like Zeit, they allow you just to serve that up if there's an issue. Well, you just redirect the user to that, and they're seamlessly into an SPA without anyone knowing the difference.
You know, I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking about the needs I've had. I've built business apps, internal ones like Ward has done, and then also some external facing ones where they're content, but they're also forms over data, heavy forms over data. So we had this strange mixture of lots and lots of JavaScript to build these apps to get them to the client, but we also had a massive need to get them there as fast as possible because they actually had business data saying that if it doesn't load in a certain amount of time, we lose X amount of money a year, which was, you know, more money than I'll ever make in my lifetime. So server-side rendering was big. But now enter the solutions that existed a couple of years ago, things like pre-render IO, which is still out there, and other pre-rendering solutions. They were complicated, noisy, exactly. Not reliable. They basically would infiltrate your development plans and really turn yourself upside down, which I think is where Ward and I are coming from on that side. But with Nuxt and Next and some of these other tools, it sounds like if you start with these, you don't really have that pain. But what I'd love for you to explain to me is this. I'm going to tell you that I'm using a tool, and the tool creates an HTML page which renders on the first load, and you can also load it from a CDN, and it will bring along the JavaScript. Now, that could be client-side rendered Angular, Vue, or React. But you're also saying that's what Nuxt does. So I'm trying to draw the separation there of if Nuxt is sending the HTML and the JavaScript in the first load, what's the difference between that and what Vue does natively?
HTML does come with Vue on the first load, of course. So pretty bare. What you get is a stub that with an ID probably of app, and then you have a JavaScript file which basically mounts Vue to that component, say, to that HTML tag, and then your app is constructed. I suppose first in the shadow DOM, and then that's inserted into the HTML. So the computation that's going on there is exactly the same computation as happens if you download a statically rendered page that's been generated by Nuxt in a build phase before being uploaded to a CDN. So you get the same hydration of what's on the page, the same building up of that application in the shadow DOM, and then trying to match it to the HTML. But I think the key difference is that it's there from the start. And I think you might say that that's not much of a key difference, but we're talking that key perception difference. And I think we're also saying that it doesn't come at any cost. So why wouldn't you want it?
Right. I think that's a big key. I mean, as Ward said, if it's easy and you're getting all these benefits, and one which I don't think we've talked about yet, unless I missed, like SEO. So if I want search engine optimization and that's important to my business application, like I'm selling products or something or services, doesn't Nuxt help me with the SEO answer as well?
The answer is, so I wouldn't point to SEO as my first reason, because Google, for example, is clever, and its engine can wait for the JavaScript to render. Obviously, it's more reliable to do it with Nuxt because you know that everything is there to start with. And there are other crawlers other than Googlebot who might not be as forbearing with JavaScript. I mean, if you're chasing every percentage point difference in your search ranking, then yes, it's a reason to do it.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Amazon.com or some, you know, Walmart.com or Disney.com, every, you know, if I'm going to gain 1% more users based upon a better SEO strategy, that could translate into, you know, 7-8 figure profit margins. So it might be good on those kind of levels, but for somebody who's building a site like, you know, my blog, I don't think it would matter, is what you're saying, right?
I think for most people, you don't need server-side rendering just for search engine optimization.
It has gotten a lot better, the way Google has attacked SEO with a lot of these JavaScript-based frameworks, Angular, Vue, React, Svelte, et cetera. So I agree there. It sounds like your big reason for doing it is it's easy, and it gives you a huge speed boost in performance for that time-to-first interactivity with the users.
So I think that it's the thing about the pendulum swing that you're talking about. So because it might seem like we're going back to where we started, but I think the big difference is the server-side rendering we're going back to now is server-side rendering, but with all the great features of client interactivity and speed and responsiveness. So I don't know if you've come across, say, quick links, which I think was one of the it was big in the Ruby world, and not just there either.
You mind explaining it real quick to folks what quick links are?
So I'll do my best. So quick links is a script that basically injects itself, runs in the browser once you've loaded a normal server-side rendered application in the old form, maybe PHP or Ruby or something like that, and then it intercepts your clicks. So if you click, the about page, it will then perform it will prevent the web browser from just doing a full page refresh, and will instead in the background fetch the content of that page, and it will simply inject the changes. So I guess similarly to it's quite different, but it will just inject the changes in the page. So what appears to happen is you don't have any white screen followed by new page content visibly downloading. Instead, you get something that feels much more seamless. As far as I understand, it's still downloading HTML, which is still being rendered on the server. So it's not quite as performant as a fully JavaScript rendered front end web application. But on the other hand, it doesn't have any performance hit in terms of computation on your computer. The thing that's giving it interactivity and this feeling of speed is purely this link clicking interceptor. So you get some speed and responsiveness, but without everything else that comes with a front end framework like a declarative rendering of your app based on data.
So, okay. So tell me this, though. I mean, there must have been, so far it's been all, you know, it's been peaches and candy. What are the downsides? What are the challenges when you're using Nuxt that maybe people should know about before they jump into this arena?
So I think one of the, so Nuxt makes it so simple to create isomorphic apps. And when I say isomorphic apps, I mean an app which has the same code running on both client and server side. So that it's really simple to write. You just write Vue in exactly the same way you normally would write Vue. That it's easy to forget that the code you're writing is run in two different contexts. It's being run in a node environment, and it's being run in a browser environment. So half of the questions I see about Nuxt when I'm helping others out is they tend to be about running browser-specific code wrongly in the node environment. So maybe you're depending on a library that uses some window API, some browser API, and it's rude. It doesn't wait to run until you call it. It actually just runs something browser-related, checks the something about the document.
Right, or tries to stick something in local storage and then retrieve it from local storage and stuff like that. Where
so any DOM specific, any APIs are specific to a DOM, for example.
Right. Turn on your camera when you're not.
Turn on your camera. There you go.
Exactly. And the server somewhere in an Amazon farm starts blinking a red light and turning its camera around. So it just doesn't work. Of course, it squawks and gives you an error. And often people struggle with that. So there are solutions. So pretty straightforward ones. So you can simply segregate your code in a plugin that only loads on the client side.
Or I've heard that what you use is you have something that's masquerading as the DOM, and so it just takes those requests and throws them away. But your code is the same. Is there something like that here? You know, like when you reference local storage, it would say, fine, you know, just have at it, but I'm going to ignore what you say. Actually, that would be a problem because you couldn't really fake that very easily. You have to give that stuff back.
No, at best you could ignore it, which probably wouldn't be a great idea either.
There's stuff like that just sort of ignores the camera call or ignores the whatever. Is there something like that built into Nux so that you... I'm going down a rabbit hole. Your point was that people get hung up. People forget that there's no real browser there and they use browser-specific commands.
Yes.
That's your point.
People do that. There's nothing like the sort of mocking or stubbing of browser APIs that I've come across. But to be honest, it sounds like you're onto something. So maybe you have to come into the community and create that, and you'll be much loved.
What word? You've been looking for that your whole life.
I've been looking for love in all the wrong places.
I have a question I'd like to get into this, and I mentioned this before when we talked about Nux and Next and other tools and SSR in general. Angular Universal is another option for Angular. Is let's say one of our listeners has an application that they love and they've built and curated over time that's built with Vue, but it's not using Nux. And all the things you're saying sound amazing, especially how easy it is to get all this. Is there a path going from an existing Vue application getting it into Nux?
It's as simple as dragging and dropping the files into the structure of a Nux application. So and to be honest, the structure of a Nux application is just convention. It's completely configurable. But for the sake of making it simple, if you just run create Nux app and npx create Nux app, you'll be left with a bare bones directory structure. It's all empty. Drag all your components into the components folder. If you've got any, maybe in Vue, you will have had a views folder. Those are probably the equivalent in Nuxt of pages. Just drop them into the pages folder, and that will pretty much work out of the box.
So the difference there is there's a pages folder and a components folder in Nuxt by default, by convention. And pages are things that will be server-side rent. They're the root pages. And then the components are pieces that go on that page?
So... It's entirely up to you, but yeah. Components tend to be things that go on the page. So the
login button,
exactly,
something like that. Yeah, autocomplete.
So is that really how applications are structured in Vue generally? That they're structured by putting files of a particular type in a folder of that type, rather than
in Nuxt. Absolutely, that you can create roots. So think of your pages directory as your roots of your application, but in file system format. So for example, you can, if you have a blog structure, maybe articles, then you would have a folder called articles with an index.view in it, and that's going to render when you go to /articles. But then maybe you have /articles, my great new blog post. Well, then you do an _article. .view, and that automatically will render anything else coming after that articles slug in your URL.
Is a way to think about this, thinking about client-side navigation routing an existing Vue app, any of the targets of your client-side routing and navigation, which are components, right? In a regular Vue app, there you target a specific component. I go to this route called /customers, and it loads the customer detail component. So any of those targets of navigations would effectively become your pages.
Exactly. Now, I should say that you don't... so that's because it makes it simpler to... Yeah. To in fact, for example, in my app, I don't use that at all. I have a router.js, and I manually control it all myself because we want to be able to do things that you might not be able to do just with a directory-based routing. So if you're migrating an existing app, then I wouldn't say, well, you have to make it fit. I would say, well, actually, use your existing router.js.
Because you can still use that same view router if you want to inside of a Nuxt app then, right?
Oh, yeah. So Nuxt is using view router under the hood.
Yeah.
And it just lets you, you can take over whenever you want. But it makes it easy for people who are starting from scratch to have something that's there to begin with.
So you can slide over easily, and then gradually, if you want to start taking advantage of some of the other features, maybe don't use the client-side router and use the server-side, or write your own router logic, as you're saying, to get more customized logic.
So yes, you can. Another thing that probably people are implementing themselves is some kind of concept of layout, where you might have your views that correspond to different pages, but then you have some functionality, some components that are shared across different views, a sort of frame around the pages that you're rendering.
Right, navigation on the left, menus at the top, status at the bottom, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. We call those, what, master pages and layouts?
Yeah, something like that.
And so in Nuxt, you just have another folder, layouts, and you drop those files in there. And then in any page you want to use one of those layouts, you just say layout is, and then you give its name. And it automatically figures out what needs to render each page.
This has been fascinating. So much. Thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on and talking about this. I think it's the best explanation of Nuxt that I've heard to date. How about you, Ward?
I can see. I can see you've had a lot of experience, Daniel, in teaching things to people, and it really comes across. Thank you.
It does, and I put a bunch of links as we were talking through this, and so did Daniel on different topics on how this all works, and the guide on Nuxt on their website is excellent as well. So I recommend folks go check that out. Daniel, as a wrap up, we like to leave our listeners with a final thought about our topic today, or it could be something just more relevant to what you're doing in today's world. So Ward, what is your final thought for our listeners today?
Oh, goodness.
Goodness is your final thought. That's nice.
Goodness is my final thought. And you know, that might be the best place to leave it. I was also going to sign off with the only remaining Greek that I have a few pleasantries like. So to Daniel Efaristopoulos. Which is thank you. Okay, that's my thought.
Excellent. I don't know any Greek, so I can't respond to you in that fashion. But Daniel, what is your final thought for our listeners?
Well, there's a word that comes in very useful. Just Ward, you probably are far ahead of me on this, but flocinauki nihilopilification. It's a great little word. It's four different Latin words for nothing, all strung together, and it means the act of evaluating something as worthless, which is not a very nice word. But sometimes you need a word for that, and
we need that in the show notes. You've got to type that in.
Yeah, I don't think I can Google that one. Just be very honest. So while Daniel's typing that in there, I'm going to leave you with a off-topic idea as a final thought. I do a lot of coaching for folks on doing public speaking, and this can be speaking at companies or speaking at your church or speaking at a conference with technology folks or any kind of speaking. And one of the videos that I love to show people, and it's only 5 minutes long, it's a TED Talk, and it's called How to Sound Smart in Your TED Talk. And it's literally a talk about nothing. It sounds like the Seinfeld of talks.
That was good, John. I thank you for sending me that link. I give it a thumbs up.
It was what I really love about it is it's not like everyone always tells you these great ideas that you have to do when you're speaking. What is great about this talk is the talk is literally about nothing. So you don't have to pay attention to what he's saying. You just have to pay attention to what he's telling you to do and how he's doing it. And I don't want to give it all away, but I find this to be one of the best videos. And again, who doesn't have 5 minutes? So one of the best videos for watching and getting ideas on how you can present yourself in any setting, quite frankly. And it's actually quite funny, too. There's funny moments in there where he does some reveals. So definitely check it out. And I believe the speaker's name is Will Steven, and it's from TEDx New York. Daniel, thank you again for coming on. And we are going to hold you to your comments about coming back on the show because we never got to GraphQL. And we want to hear all about GraphQL and how it works with you and Nuxt. Can we set that up?
I'd love to come back.
Well, you were fascinating and entertaining and engaging the whole way through. And you taught us a word that I don't think I could ever pronounce. And it's in the show notes, so I'm not even going to try. Thanks
it
again.
It sounds like something that you should get injected.
Yes.
For a very bad infection.
Maybe for coronavirus. There you go.
That's topical, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And thank you all for coming back and listening to us another episode of Real Talk JavaScript. We really appreciate you. We appreciate our sponsors. And thank you. You hear from us every Tuesday morning.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter at RealTalkJS.